Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 36 of season 12 of Movie Robin, the daily podcast where we dig our way through the 1994 film The Shawshank Redemption, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me this week is Jess Rogers Pearson, a former podcaster who still likes coming back and talking about movies by minute. So I'm very happy about that. Welcome back, Jess.
Thanks, Rob. I'm really happy to be back. I wish life hadn't gotten in the way of podcasting more and definitely watching more movies. So it's exciting to be back again. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, I think the last time you were on was season 5. So it's been, what is it, 7 seasons. So it's nice to refresh the guests back, you know, bring them nice. Back and get them back into the mode of talking about a movie, 1 minute at a time. You know, most people don't. It's like I see it like riding a bicycle, you know, the type of thing that once you get back on, it just comes back real quickly. You remember how to do it, what you need to do, and all that stuff. So, you know, that's always good and fun.
Agreed.
Yeah. So, all right, let's start off with the simple question that I ask everybody. What is your background with the Shawshank Redemption?
So it's kind of random. In the year, I remember the year it came out, and because I'm old enough, and I remember it getting nominated for an Oscar, and we hadn't seen it, hadn't heard anything about it. My parents were very big into movies, and I remember watching the Oscars that year and it being nominated, and the marketing team did a great job. It's very branded red, right? Like a lot of the poster background is red. A lot of the seats they sit in, like red is very deliberately a color besides the gray of the prison. Mm-hmm. And my younger brain was like, oh, this must take place in China. And it's got this weird word in the name, Shawshank. That doesn't mean anything. I think my brain heard rickshaw in some way and made rickshaw into Shawshank. And then, so my, literally, this is my thought of what this movie was until I finally saw it in college a couple of years later. This movie is about a prison in China. And for some reason, it has Morgan Freeman and Tim Robbins, but no people of Asian appearance.
Correct.
So it wasn't a lot of logic thinking through this, but I remember strongly thinking this is about a prison in China once upon a time. So odd memory of it, but thankfully that is not in fact what it's about, because it's an amazing movie set in Maine.
Yes. Are you a Stephen King fan?
No, as a rule, I am not a horror or a scary movie fan, but I definitely have some of his that I absolutely adore. I think they're the ones that are on the edge of truly scary and terrifying.
Okay.
Some of his stories I can definitely get through, and some I just have never even tried.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, again, I'm the same way. I'm not a horror person. I don't like scary stuff. I actually started reading Stephen King stories with things like Shawshank and The Body and...
The Green Mile.
Okay, right. The Green Mile. Right. The Green Mile came out 10 years later. But I mean, I was, in the 80s when I was a teenager. That's when I was starting to read the Stephen King stuff, and I stayed far away from all of the horror stuff. You know, I knew that there was enough non-horror to read, and you know, I always loved his writing and the way that he describes characters and things like that.
So agreed. For the few I've read.
Yeah. So yeah, so I had read Shawshank before I saw the movie, and when I saw the movie, I didn't remember the connection. I didn't remember that I had read the book, you know, because it was a few years later. And so like, friends dragged me to go see the movie, and I'm like, okay, I'll go see the movie. You know, why not? Whatever the Shawshank thing is. And as the movie's going along, I know I've told the story that other people have already heard it, but that's fine. As the movie is moving along, I'm saying to myself, this sounds so familiar. And you know, it all started coming back to me as I was going through it, you know. And then obviously,
right.
The, obviously, I went back and reread
book is
it.
Called, you know. Right, because the book is called Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption, but the movie is just Shawshank.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Remembering that correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean that's part of the whole thing. All right, so minute 36 begins with Red warning Andy, and ends with Hadley getting ready to drop Andy off the roof. Basically, the way we left things off on Friday was, you have all these guys doing the tarring of the roof in the I guess the warm May spring day. And Andy's starting to hear a little bit about what's going on with the guards that are sitting there having their own conversation. He hears what's going on,
Oh yeah.
and he knows they all hear just like we did, that Hadley got an inheritance. And okay, so what's going to be with this inheritance? And these the guards are just shooting the breeze, talking about things that are going on, while they're. Because for them, it's also an easy detail. This just like the 12 prisoners that they have let out for this type of job. They get to work outdoors. They don't have to work in the sweaty laundry and all that stuff. But for the guards, it's the same type of thing. They can also be outdoors, and if the weather is as nice as they say it is, which it looks like it is, why not? And you also see that the guards are pretty lax, and we'll
Yeah, they're
see.
in an enclosed space. Like, it's not like the prisoners are going to jump off the roof. They can't really go anywhere. The guards are all standing right there by the door.
Exactly. So at this point, Red finishes his sentence of what he was starting to say yesterday, and he goes, "Man, Andy, the whole idea was he's trying to make sure that Andy, gets back to work and doesn't he's." He's paying too much attention to the guards, which I mean we talked a little bit about this on Friday. The idea that Andy's ears popped up when someone started talking about paying taxes and getting an inheritance and stuff like that. It's just really funny that it's a banker, and that it, and the truth is it's something that happens to all of us. You're in a place and you hear something that is of interest to you that someone else is having a conversation about, and you immediately zone in on what they're saying to try to understand it. That's a
Yeah, and there's a certain kind of person who also will jump in to try to help, right? Like, oh, I just did this thing, I solved it, I know how to help you with what you're trying to do. And it does this really interesting version of showing Andy doing that.
Right.
This idea that he wants to be, oh, I'm tuning in to, I can help, like I went to Disney World with my nieces last year, and so when I see either online or in a restaurant people talking about taking kids to Disneyland, I perk up like I have some experience I can share about this thing. And it really felt like that moment for Andy.
And I think it also goes with the fact that the fact that everyone has painted Andy as this cold-blooded killer, which we'll find out as the movie goes through that he didn't do it. But when you're first watching this, you're not 100% sure. They do leave it very in the air. It's very ambiguous whether he did it or didn't do it. Which I think Darabont does a great job with that, because you don't you want to believe that he's innocent, but they also give you the facts. And up until now, the facts that we've heard make it sound as if okay, this guy. Was overcome with rage and decided to kill his wife and her lover. And it makes sense within the context of the way that they're telling us all that. But on the other hand, you're saying, okay, this is a protagonist. I want to like him, so I want to believe that he's not a murderer. That type of thing.
But it adds that underlying tension to everything he's thinking about doing. Like, as he's walking over to talk to Hadley, is he about to do something scary? Because we don't know the combo of it's written by Stephen King, the combo of we don't know if he is a cold-blooded murderer. And now we're about to hear this real side of Andy can be really tough.
That's true, and one of the things that I'm looking at it and looking at this and saying, on the one hand, we're supposed to think of Andy as this cold-blooded killer, but on the other hand, he apparently, and we'll find this out during the course of the movie, he's a very good banker. He knows his job. He knows what he needs to do as a banker. Whatever, I don't know if he has a degree in economics or business or whatever it is. I mean, it doesn't matter. but this is a guy who knows the field of banking and money. And one of the great things about that is it's basically giving us the opportunity to, he wants to help people. So
Yeah, he's deep into that as a
that's
underlying
right.
piece, and it's very opposite to this feeling of you're in prison where everyone's out
That's
for
right.
themselves. Although we do get this t small tie-in to Red, which comes back, I think, in the last minute we'll discuss later this week, is Red is the guy who knows how to get things. So Red helps people, not altruistically, but it does. Just focusing in on these 5 minutes for this week, I really got this connection between why Red and Andy are
Right.
friends.
Exactly. I mean, again, at the end of the week, we'll talk a little bit more about Red's background based on what it tells us in the book, because it does touch upon a little bit here, that type of thing. But Andy is basically in a trance right now, and it's actually funny because this happens to me a lot. Sometimes I'll be somewhere with my wife, and we'll be doing our own thing, whatever it is, we're waiting in line or whatever it is, and then I'll hear a conversation. And it'll be something that is of interest, and I've then now, focused in on that. And she always laughs because like I'll pick up my head, like I'll be, I don't know, I'll be reading, I'll be on my computer or my phone, whatever it is, and I hear a conversation, and then my head pops up. So it made me think of Andy.
You have
Yes,
a tell. Now
exactly,
you're engaged.
exactly. Because oh. And you want to know what they're
Sure.
saying. You want to know if it's something that's interesting. And again, I also sometimes feel the urge. I don't act on that urge to offer advice if someone is saying something, especially if they're talking about a movie and
Yeah.
they're wrong, that type of thing. But I usually just okay. I'm just quiet, Like I remember this must have been about 3.5, 4 years ago. There were I went to see a showing of Jaws, in the theater. And it wasn't a very crowded theater, whatever it was. And a few
Wow.
rows above me, there was a father, probably in his late 50s, early 60s, with his teenage daughter there. And at the end, and I'm like, oh wow, that's so cool. He's bringing his daughter to see it and whatever. And then at the very end, he goes, yeah, I didn't like this movie back then either. And I'm like, you have to know Jaws is a great movie. What type of comment is that? And
Wow.
I held myself back from responding because there's no need to. I'm not gonna be able to convince someone on the spot after, especially after just
Right.
watching the movie, if they said they didn't like it. I'm not gonna say, oh, but didn't you pay attention to this and that? Yeah,
Watching it on
and
the big screen.
didn't you notice this and that and the other thing? It's like I just didn't go but it's just very funny.
Right.
So. Yeah.
That's awesome. And clearly it
Yes.
stuck with you
Yes.
that it was a moment you could have
Yes, of
responded
course. Of
in that
course.
way.
Moments like that always stick with you. Yeah.
The piece that gets me is as this sort of moment is progressing, is Andy had multiple ways to jump into this conversation, right? Like he could have asked the guards politely, he could have sucked up into this moment to be part of their conversation. And he starts with such a provocative question that has nothing to do with taxes or banking per se. And he starts and he jumps into this with, do you trust your wife?
That's
It's
right.
such an
And again,
accusation.
it's done that way on purpose. But we'll get there. We'll get there. We're jumping a little ahead of ourselves here. So no, that's okay. That's okay.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So then the shot focuses on the guards, and we have Trout talking to Hadley, and also I mean it's great, when you're doing when you're watching a movie this way and you know all of these characters' names. They're because
Yeah.
when up in, until I started doing the actual research for this season, I didn't know any of the names of most of the cons. I didn't know the names of most of the guards and stuff like that. But when you're doing it this way, so you start to get to know who they are. I mean, some of the actors I've recognized and stuff like that. Like I obviously everyone knows who Haywood is and everyone knows who Hadley is and things like that. But the lesser guy, I mean, the fact that you have characters named Skeet, Jigger, Lloyd, Snooze, and Ernie. I had no idea about that beforehand. And then
No,
the guards' names,
for
you have
sure.
Mert, Trout, Youngblood, and Deacons. Deacons, I've heard the name.
Deacons, I think, is one of the,
Right.
yeah, we hear the name once or twice, but I don't think most of the others are even said out
That's right.
loud in the
That's right.
movie.
They're not. And so, you just have to, you if you look at the credits or you see it on IMDb, so then you'll know the name of all of these different guards and stuff like that. But Paul McCrane, who I don't know if you're familiar with him from
From
ER,
ER,
exactly. Right.
yeah.
Okay. So Rocket Romano. So he and this is like right before he actually even started, on ER, but I'd say it's a few years before because this is 94. ER started in 94. But he's the main guard having the conversation at this point, and he says, "Well, you pay some tax, but you'll still end up." And Hadley just cuts him off and goes, "Oh yeah, maybe enough to buy a new car. Then what? I got to pay tax on the car, repair, maintenance. Goddamn kids pestering me to take him for a ride." And at this point, we see that Andy starts looking at Hadley even more. And, now he really wants to get into this conversation. And Hadley continues and goes, "And at the end of the year, you figure the tax wrong, you pay them out of your own pocket. I tell you, Uncle Sam." So, what do you know about the term Uncle Sam?
I think it was created for war propaganda bombs, but I don't know exactly when or why.
What would be your guess?
I would guess for World War II, but it might have been World War
It
I.
was World War One was when it really became popular, even though they started using the character a century earlier during the War of 1812.
Wow. Okay.
There's
Are you going to tell me who Sam was?
well, again, it's inconclusive because there are multiple options, I guess. But the assumption is that it was named after someone named Samuel Wilson, okay? Who during the War of 1812, he was a meat packer, okay? He was a meat packer in New York around that time. So, it just I guess the idea is that someone decided to they liked thinking of him, and they're not really sure. The exact reasons of he was known as Uncle Sam. That's what you have also in his gravestone. And they think, let's put it this way, when Congress made a resolution about the name of Uncle Sam, they do refer to him. Okay, so on September 15, 1861, so the resolution was resolved by the Senate and the House of Representatives that the Congress salutes Uncle Sam Wilson of Troy, New York, as the progenitor of America's national symbol of Uncle Sam. Okay, but again, nobody really knows 100%. But it's nice to think about the fact that it's very possible. I mean, he was helping to supply troops during the War of 1812 with food, with supplies of meat and stuff like that. So he was dealing with rations and
Makes
stuff like
sense.
that. So I guess you can sort of say, hey, our Uncle Sam is
Yeah,
helping us out,
maybe where did this meat come from, Uncle Sam?
Exactly. So that's very possible. Again, it's a little obscure knowing exactly if it's named after him or not. But again, it's nice to believe that it is. Cuz why not?
Sure.
Why not? I mean, also he's a meat packer who,
No, it makes sense. I
right.
mean, it's a cool story.
But the idea of the personification or the character of Uncle Sam, it's basically the national personification of the US, basically referring to the federal government or possibly the country as a whole. And it's basically been used as a way of showing patriotism. And as you said, during World War I, he was prominently featured in military propaganda recruiting posters and things like that. Uncle Sam wants you, I want you, things like that, with
Sure.
the picture of Uncle Sam pointing at the at whoever's looking at the picture, that type of thing. There is a book that came out in 1816, which was called The Adventures of Uncle Sam in Search of His Lost Honor, which is the earliest
Oh, wow.
reference to the earliest reference in literature, I guess, of the title of Uncle Sam. Do you know what the female figure of that is used to personify America is? So you have Uncle Sam, and then you have a female figure. Who do you think of? Do you know who that is?
It's usually either, it depends on if you're going older or newer. It's Betsy Ross or maybe Rosie the Riveter.
Well, actually, it's
I
no,
don't
it's
know. What do you
well,
think?
it's Columbia.
Oh,
Lady Columbia.
yeah. Lady Liberty.
No, not Lady
Yeah.
Liberty, Lady Columbia.
Not Lady Liberty,
Right.
but her image is sort of, yeah, they're similar in some ways.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not, I know what you're talking about, but it doesn't feel nearly as
No, of course not. Of
ubiquitous.
course not. It's not. But
Yeah.
but that's
I mean,
you know that.
it's the symbol for one of the movie studios,
Yes.
right? For
That's
Columbia
right. That's
Movies.
right. But again, it's
It
it part of the
was.
whole idea is showing the patriotism, and they use these in newspapers for caricatures to represent various things. At the time,
Yeah.
it was much easier. You'd see a political cartoon or a phrase within the newspaper, and it's saying, okay, we're referring to Uncle Sam, we're referring to Columbia, whatever it is. So, that works well too, from that same perspective. Because also Lady Columbia went back a long time before the Revolutionary War even. That was already back in 1738. They're
Oh,
referring
wow.
to the US as Columbia, Miss Columbia, stuff like
Interesting.
that. And then after the Revolutionary War, they had a character named Brother Jonathan, who became the male personification. But that he
Okay.
eventually was I guess taken over by Uncle Sam eventually. Again, I
Gotcha.
like the idea of Uncle Sam as the personification of America. I mean, I think it's great because it's an older man. Basically, it's very patriotic the way that he's presented usually. Sometimes for good, sometimes for bad.
Usually. Yeah.
It's
It's not an image. Yeah, it's not an image that has been corrupted, at
that's right.
least. Sometimes yes for bad, but it's not like it's not political per se. It's whatever the current federal government is and representing it as a part of a long-standing thing. So yeah, Uncle Sam hasn't exactly, as much as they curse them, like Hadley here. It's not necessarily something that's meant to be derided.
Now, I mean, one of the I guess jokes about the idea of Uncle Sam is what are the initials of Uncle Sam?
US.
So again, it fits in there also. Because Columbia, Miss Columbia is MC. That doesn't, MC Hammer is the closest I would come to it. And
Yeah, she was
they
quite
probably
early
didn't
for that.
think, yeah, they probably didn't think about that pre-revolution though.
No.
Probably not. But yeah, so that's Uncle Sam. So basically, Andy at this point just he starts walking, and it looks like he's in a trance the way that he's
Yeah, it
walking.
does.
He's walking towards Hadley, and he's getting a little faster as he's walking along. And Hadley continues complaining, and he goes, he puts his hand in your shirt and squeezes your till it's purple. And Red notices what's going on with Andy. And he basically alerts the other guys that are tarring, and he goes, "Andy, Andy!" And Haywood goes, "What's he doing?" And Floyd goes, "Getting himself killed." And then Jigger says, "Keep tarring." And we see Andy comes all the way up to where the guards are. And then Hadley goes, "Some brother." He goes, "Shit!" And then he spits, spits on the ground. And like the guards are in their own world, in their own conversation, they're not paying any attention to the fact that Andy is there.
Right.
And so suddenly they notice that he's there. And like one of the guys even cocks his gun, really quickly. And Trout goes, "Hey." And at this point, all the cons start looking at what's going on. They've stopped what they're doing. And Andy just looks at Hadley and goes, "Mr. Hadley, do you trust your wife?" So it
Yeah.
goes back to what you were saying before. I mean, this is a very strange comment to make.
Yeah.
There are much saner ways to, I guess, approach Hadley than to say, "Do
Yep.
you trust your wife?" That isn't the first thing that should normally be coming into someone's mind when they're doing that.
Right. It's such unrelated to what the tarring has been doing, or maybe he's coming up to ask for more tar, or can he go to the bathroom, right? There are reasons he would be approaching them per se,
That's right.
but not to start with something like, do you trust your wife? It's a very sort of shocking way to approach the guards. It's very personal, right? They're not supposed to be asking very personal things of the guards. That's not how this is supposed to go. And in fact, the guards aren't supposed to tell them personal things, I presume. It just gives ammunition.
That's right. So yeah, that's just it's very interesting the way that the way that they chose to do that King chose to do it, because if you go into the novel, the novella, this is the way it is written, and I'll read that shortly and to explain how that goes. And Hadley just looks at him and goes, "Oh, that's funny." And he pulls out his nightstick, ready to beat him, and he goes, "You're gonna look funnier sucking my d with no teeth." The one of the guards in the back pulls his gun and is pointing it at Andy. I mean, again, nowadays I don't think guards in prisons walk around with guns for obvious reasons, but apparently back
Yeah.
in 1949 they didn't have a problem with that.
Yeah. And it might be different in the prison versus them out where they are now, but even enclosed on a roof, locked onto a roof, it'd be weird. Yeah.
No, because of the fear that someone might try to take one of the guns. That type of thing.
Absolutely.
And at this point, Andy just keeps talking, even though he's being grabbed by the collar. And he goes, "What I mean is, do you think she'd go behind your back, try to hamstring you?" So, are you familiar with the term hamstring someone? Not the body part. I know you're a biologist, so you know all about the hamstring itself.
As a concept, I think it's referring to a phrase of cutting someone's hamstring because then you can't walk or run or something like that.
Yes, of course.
It's not a phrase I use routinely. It's a little more violent than I think is intended in the phrase.
That's true. That's true. Right. So to hamstring something means to limit, disable, or render it powerless. Physically, as you said, it refers to cutting the leg tendons, but figuratively, it means severely hindering the process or effectiveness of something. I mean, you probably know where the original medical term comes from, hamstring or whatever. So I'm not even going to go into that because that's no real need to do that. But it's interesting the way. I mean, anyone who follows sports, you hear a lot that people pull a hamstring or things like that. And so it's interesting that someone at some point decided to start using that phrase to refer to trying to disable somebody. Because
Yeah.
I guess they came up with the idea that okay, once your real hamstring is done, you're done too. So
Right. Yeah, you can't really walk.
that's right. And Hadley still doesn't really care, and he goes, "That's it. Step aside, Mert." And we see that Mert basically just turns away, and looks in the opposite direction, and he goes, "This is having himself an accident." And Haywood then whispers, with the cons, he goes, "He's gonna push him off." And we see that Hadley is walking briskly towards the edge of the roof with Andy in tow, because he's holding him by the collar. Basically, Andy's in front of him. He's like pushing Andy a little bit, and Andy continues, like he doesn't even try to stop his conversation. And he goes, "Because if you do trust her, there's no reason you can't keep that 35,000." And we see that Andy is like on the edge. And he's, just about to basically go off if he takes one more step or loses his balance or whatever. And then Hadley looks at him and goes, "What did you say? 35,000?" And that's actually the way that this minute ends. So we're gonna have to wait until tomorrow to find out, whether he's going to be throwing him off the roof or not. It's just one of those things.
And it's such an amazing ramp up of tension by Darabont in this 1 minute. Like they're just peaceful, chit-chatting, shooting the breeze, and then in this 1 minute, you go from, are they going to hurt him, right? You have no trust in the guards, to, oh, Andy's trying to be a real person. He's getting in on this. He's trying to talk to them. What's he doing? Is he crazy? And they do so much tension building in 1 minute. It's impressive, and it's one of the bigger tension moments of the movie, I think.
Right. Exactly. And I like the way they do that. It definitely keeps us on the edge here. No pun intended. Or pun intended. It could
Pun
be.
intended, that's a perfect one.
Yeah. So the novella talks a little bit about this, so I'll read part of it because again, over the course of the week we're gonna get more of this whole story. But so it says Hadley was a tall, shambling man with thinning red hair. He sunburned easily and he talked loud. And if you didn't move fast enough to suit him, he'd clout you with his stick. On that day, our third on the roof, he was talking to another guard named Ernthwistle. Hadley had gotten some amazingly good news, so he was griping about it. That was his style. He was a thankless man with no with not a good word for anyone. A man who was convinced the whole world was against him. The world had cheated him out of the best years of his life, and the world would be more than happy to cheat him out of the rest. I've seen some screws that I thought were more saint, or almost saintly, and I think I know why that happens. They're able to see the difference between their own lives, poor and struggling as they might be, and the lives of the men they are paid by the state to watch over. These guards are able to formulate a comparison concerning pain. Others can't or won't. For Byron Hadley, there was no basis of comparison. He could sit there cool and at ease under the warm May sun and find the gall to mourn his own good luck while less than 10 feet away, a bunch of men were working and sweating and burning their hands on great big buckets filled with bubbling tar. Men who had to work so hard in their ordinary round of days that this looked like a respite. You may remember the old question, the one that's supposed to define your outlook on life when you answer it. For Byron Hadley, the answer would always be half empty. The glass is half empty. Forever and ever, amen. If you gave him a cool drink of apple cider, he'd think about vinegar. If you told him his wife had always been faithful to him, he'd tell you it was because she was so damn ugly. So there he sat, talking to Mert and Entwistle, loud enough for all of us to hear. His broad white forehead had already starting to redden with the sun. He had one hand thrown back over the low parapet surrounding the roof. The other was on the butt of his 38. We all got the story along with Mert. It seems that Hadley's older brother had gone off to Texas some 14 years ago, and the rest of the family hadn't heard from the son of a bitch since. They had all assumed he was dead, and good riddance. Then a week and a half ago, a lawyer had called him long distance from Austin. It seems that Hadley's brother had died 4 months earlier, and a rich man at that. It's friggin' incredible how lucky some assholes can get, his paragon of gratitude on the plate chopped roof said. The money had come as a result of oil and oil leases, and there was close to $1 million. No, Hadley wasn't a millionaire. That might have even made him happy, at least for a while. But his brother had left a pretty damn decent bequest of $35,000 to each surviving member of his family back in Maine, if they could be found. Not bad, like getting lucky and winning the sweepstakes. But to Byron Hadley, the glass was always half empty. He spent most of the morning bitching to Murt about the bite that the goddamn government was going to take out of his windfall. They leave me about enough to buy a new car with, he allowed. And then what happens? You have to pay the damn taxes on the car and the repairs and the maintenance. You get your goddamn kids pestering you to take them for a ride with the top down and to drive it if they're old enough, Mert said. Old Mert Ernthwistle knew which side his bread was buttered on, and he didn't say what must have been obvious to him and to the rest of us. If the money's worth worrying you so bad, Byron, old kick old sock, I'll just take it off your hands after all. What are friends for? That's right, wanting to drive it, wanting to learn how to drive it for Christ's sakes, Byron said with a shudder. Then what happened at the end of the year? If you figure the tax wrong, you don't have enough left over to pay the overdraft. You got to pay out from your own pocket, and maybe even borrow it from one of those kikey loan agencies. And they audit you anyway, it doesn't matter. And when the government audits you, they always take more. Who can fight Uncle Sam? He puts his hand inside your shirt and squeezes your until it's purple, and you end up getting the short end. Christ, he lapsed in a morose silence, thinking of what terrible bad luck he'd had to inherit the $35,000. Andy Dufresne has been spreading tar with the big pad brush less than 15 feet away, and now he tosses it into the pail and walks over to where Merton Hadley were sitting. Well, we all tightened up, and I saw one of the other screws, Tim Youngblood, drag his hand down to where his pistol was bolstered. One of the fellows in the sentry tower struck his partner on the arm, and they both turned too. For one moment, I thought Andy was going to get shot or clubbed, and then he said very softly to Hadley, "You trust your wife?" Hadley just stared at him. He was starting to get red in the face, and I knew that was a bad sign. In about 3 seconds, he was going to pull his billy and give Andy the butt end of it right in the solar plexus where the big bundle of nerves is. A hard enough hit that can kill you, but they always go for it. If it doesn't kill you, it will paralyze you long enough to forget whatever cute move it was that you had planned. "Boy," Hadley said, "I'll give you just one chance to pick up that pad, and then you're going off this roof on your head." Andy just looked at him very calm and still. His eyes were like ice. It was as if he hadn't heard, and I found myself wanting to tell him how it was, give him the crash course. Again, we'll continue tomorrow with the rest of that. But the idea is that I think that Darabont did a nice job of putting that everything I just read now to screen within less than a minute.
Yeah, perfectly.
Here it took me a lot longer to read all of that than less than a minute,
Yeah.
and but they were able to succinctly tell this story, and I liked it.
Yeah,
I
you
think
can
they're
really see all of those descriptions. The
yes.
tension that ramps up in that 1 second as the body posture changes in all the guards when they realize Andy's there, Andy's locked in version. Yeah, you described it all and we got to see it so they didn't have to say it. You're right.
Exactly.
Very
And
cool.
again, this goes back to what I said before about King being an amazingly descriptive writer.
Yes.
Again,
Think that's
we
where the fear is generated from how vivid his descriptions can be
exactly.
when he's writing horror.
Would you have anything else you want to say about this particular minute?
Nope, we covered everything.
All right, excellent. So we will now go to today's segment, which is Main Man Monday, where my guests will give their top five Stephen King adaptations.
So I wasn't sure if Shawshank should be one of them, but
Oh, it can be. It's
it can be.
yes, it's not excluded.
fair. Then I would give, so I do have five others just in case. I would put Shawshank above any of them. I think it's by far the best adaptation from writing that any, out of almost any movie that's out there, but it's also one of his best. And he has a lot of really good ones.
Yes.
So you just want me to list them?
Sure. Start with your number five and work your way up. And
My number five,
well, start with your honorable mention, because now you've bumped something off the list. So.
I guess then my honorable mention would be Secret Window.
Okay.
I think they do a really good job, and just like the passage you just read, you can really feel what must have been on the page to get to Johnny Depp in that cabin and the way all of that movie comes together. Number four, or number five, I guess now, is Misery. I actually read part of this at some point and then lost the book, so I never went back and finished it. And it made me too scared, honestly, to see the movie until I was definitely an adult. But I loved it. And then I saw Stand By Me when I was a kid, so that's my number four. And it, I was just about their age, and it freaked me out like crazy. And then I saw it again and as an adult, and it's just one of those movies that sticks with you. It's done so well all the way through. I have probably seen my number three the most times, and that's The Shining, because it is the one sort of violation of scary movies I can handle. It's like there's not the same kind of, there's a lot of tension, but there's not a lot of gore. And so I like The Shining. And then the only one I've read all the way through, which is The Green Mile, as I mentioned earlier, that I love the way that was brought to the screen. I think Tom Hanks does an amazing job. A lot of the supporting cast, I hate. Oh my gosh, of course his name just went out of my head. Sam
Of course,
Rockwell. I hated him so
you're supposed
much as
to.
I know, and he, that's what I mean. He does such a good job, and I hate him so much. And it's such a good capture from the book to the page, although Stephen King does a better job really giving depth to each of the other inmates on death row. And then number one has to be Shawshank. It's such a good adaptation. It's just a phenomenal movie on its own, but even just proof from the passage you just read, the conversion from the page to the screen is so well done.
Yeah, and again, the thing that always gets me is the novella is like 70 something pages. You know, it's not even that long, and you have a two
Right.
hour and 20 minute movie from it. So,
Yeah, it's
yeah.
perfect.
Again, Darabont was born to adapt King to the screen. You know, and it's unfortunate
Yeah,
he's
absolutely.
only done a very few of them. You know, he should be doing more.
Yeah.
But there's nothing we can do about that. We just have to deal with it, I guess.
Yep.
That's life. All right, now we will play the first of two games. The
Okay.
first game is called Name That Novel Adaptation. So the idea is that I made a list of movies that are based on novels, but the movie and the novel have different titles, like Rita Hayworth and Shawshank
Oh, okay.
Redemption. And the Shawshank Redemption, obviously, I wouldn't put that on the list because it's a little too easy to figure out. You need to do a little bit of muscle exercise, brain exercise, trying to figure it out. I always bring the perfect example of Schindler's Ark. So obviously most people will know what that movie is. It's not, so you know.
Sure.
So what I'm going to do is I'll tell you the original title, the year that the movie came out, and you have to try and guess what movie it is. Okay, we'll have one of these every day. All right, so let's spin
Okay.
the wheel and see what you get. It's completely random. I have no idea what you're going to get. Okay, this is a movie that came out in 1985, and it is based
Okay.
on the Shakespeare play, King
Oh
Lear.
gosh. 1985? Can you give me some of a hint?
Sure, of course. It was directed by Kurosawa.
Oh, that's not going to get me very far, unfortunately. Not in 1985. King Lear.
Okay. I'm trying to think if there's any other hint that I can try and give you that'll help you try and get it. It stars Tatsuya Nakadai. I don't
No.
think that's gonna help.
No, I sorry. 1985. I gotta
Okay,
give
so
up.
it's the movie Ran, RAN,
I don't think I've heard of it.
which is it's a pretty interesting
Sure.
movie. Especially if you know the story of
Yeah.
King Lear. So.
Oh, very cool. I'll put it on my
But
list.
it all takes place in feudal Japan, and the I mean the cinematography and the costumes and everything and the way that they choreograph all the battles is
I
just
bet.
really amazing.
Oh, thank you for the recommendation.
Okay. No problem. It was
Yeah,
random.
that's fine. I'll do better tomorrow.
It was a random
Yeah.
recommendation. There you go. I hope you do. And so now we will go to the second game, which is called High Low.
Okay.
So the idea behind this game is that I will randomly give you the name of a Oscar Best Picture nominee between 1950 and now, and you have to try and guess what its IMDb rating is and what its Rotten Tomatoes percentage is. Okay, and
Okay.
just to give you a baseline, so the Shawshank Redemption is a 9.3 IMDb
Great.
rating and is a 91% Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay.
Obviously, nothing will be above 9.3 since Shawshank is still number one on IMDb.
Wow.
From that perspective, you don't have to worry. So you'll have three of these every day.
Okay, cool.
So let's spin the wheel and see what you get.
Do I win if I get close, or are we doing prices right? Do
Yeah,
I have to get
you don't
under?
have, it doesn't have, no, it doesn't have to be exact. The idea is get a ballpark.
Sure.
Okay, the 2011 film with George Clooney, The
Oh,
Descendants.
I like that movie. Let's say a 7.8 on IMDb and probably more like a 65 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay, so on IMDb, you're very close.
Okay.
It's 7.3,
Okay.
so that's good. On Rotten Tomatoes, it's an
Oh, I
87.
went the wrong
So
way. Okay.
yeah, you went the
I
wrong way
guess
on
I
that
don't
one.
know a lot of
But
people who loved it. I really like it, so I should have trusted myself.
yeah, there you go. I liked it. I like it too. But and I think 87 is around the right area for it.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was an amazing movie, but it was very good.
And it's
That's
remarkably
all.
rewatchable even for the content, right? It's about someone dying, but it's got so much interesting rewatchable content. I still die every time the grandfather punches the boyfriend in the face. It's just the best second.
All right, let's spin the wheel for your next one. Oh wow, you got another movie from 2011, Midnight in Paris.
Ooh, Midnight in Paris, I bet is a hmm 8.2 on IMDb and a 88 on Rotten Tomatoes. That one seems like it's a crowd pleaser. Am I wrong?
Okay, so yeah, you're a little wrong on both of those.
Okay.
IMDb is 7.7.
Okay.
Rotten Tomatoes is 93.
Oh, okay. It was higher. How
Yeah.
high was Shawshank for Rotten Tomatoes?
91.
Oh, okay.
Again, I've said this many times. I don't understand about those 9% of people. I don't get
No. But the 93. Okay. So I was capping at my thinking on 91. So good to know.
No,
But I should.
you have to cap
It's
for
only the
IMDb
IMDb.
for
Okay.
right. The truth is there are movies that have 100% or 99%, but most of them are usually older movies, from the 50s and 60s, when I guess it's
Sure.
more difficult to cull the all the reviews and stuff like that.
Right.
So,
That makes sense.
all right, let's spin for your last one today. And for your final one today, it's the 1950 movie Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, wow. Sunset Boulevard. Okay, the other two were in the sevens. I don't love this movie. It's good for many reasons, but the stage play is better. I don't know, like a 6.9 on IMDb. I'm probably way off from my own bias. And a 75 on Rotten
Well, you
Tomatoes. Oh no, you said it the other way. It's a 90 on Rotten Tomatoes because the older movies have fewer negative reviews to
am
find.
first of all, I'm very glad that you remembered my little hint there, without even knowing that we were going to get a movie from 1950. Rotten Tomatoes has 98%, but
Wow.
you
Okay.
but revising
Yeah.
it is very was a very wise move, and IMDb is 8.4. So
Okay.
it is something that's highly regarded.
Yeah, it is. Just not one of my
Okay,
personal
that's
favorites.
understandable. That's understandable. So my assumption is it won't appear tomorrow on your Talking Tuesday list of narrating movies that are narrated.
No, it
Spoiler for anybody who is expecting. That would have been a great surprise. I got to tell you that. But all right. So Jess, would you like to tell people where they can get in touch with you?
You can find me on Threads usually. You can usually find me on Instagram or Facebook. And if you've been following any of the Lambs or my previous podcast, Real Insight is still out there for listening if you wish. Please check me out. I am Eco River and Threads if you're coming to
All right.
look for me.
Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Raw Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierawminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to rob@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, get busy living.
Or get busy dying.